So I would like to spend my last lecture talking about fun things, experiments that have been done to verify the random matrix philosophy in number theory. Okay? And these experiments fall into two categories, zeros and values. Okay? And now for zeros, two types of experiments have been done. Those that look at zeros of a fixed L function, and you go up high in the critical strip, and then you can compute things like correlations between zeros, spacings, distributions. By now, I think we tend to regard this as a family, okay? And here you're varying T, okay? So that would be your family. But still, the experiments that you do here are distinct from the ones where you average over many L functions, because you are going up at high T where you have universal behavior. When you look at zeros in a family, you can detect more specific information than you can by going way up high. Okay, so for zeros in a family, you might look at things like density of the zeros, and this is most interesting near the critical point. And then for values within a family of, well, not just within a, so T aspect is a family, so you can look at moments on the critical line or moments at the critical point in as you vary over many L functions. You might ask yourself about how the values are distributed. You might ask very specific information which you would think that random matrix theory would not be able to touch, such as questions about ranks of elliptic curves. Okay, so you can actually say things in that case too. Okay. So let me... Okay, so for Riemann zeta, what's been done? So I'm not going to show what Lipschitz pictures, because those have been shown enough times already. Let me say, as far as zeta goes, the two most extensive computations to date, one is concerned with verifying RH. I won't say that falls into these random matrix theory type of connections. I mean, you are checking that they fall on a line. I mean, that's why we're interested in the random matrix theory connections, because we want to know why they fall on a line. Okay, in his case, he's now gotten up to almost a trillion zeros. So he's not computed the zeros, but he's counted zeros by looking for sign changes on the critical line. He and several thousand participants on the web, okay? And he's using essentially code that Herman Turiel wrote, and he's just distributed it on the web, and he gets paid by IBM to do that, so not bad. Okay, so Odlitzko has computed billions of zeros near the 10 to the 20, 22nd, 23rd, 24th, etc. Okay, and he's found tremendous agreement with random matrix theory statistics, okay, and the nicest pictures we've seen in this talk of his, and then that took into account some secondary corrections. We saw that in Bogomolny's talk. So Bogomolny and Keating obtained secondary terms for the pair correlation for the zeros of zeta. And those secondary terms involve zeta on the one line. Okay, and comparison with the Odlitzko data is perfect up to Gaussian noise. Okay, I mean, that's what they seem to be conjecturing. Oh, I can skip them. Okay, so first let me tell you how you look for zeros. Okay, so you rotate your L function so that it is real on the critical line. So you might look at Z of t, for example, instead of zeta of a half plus it. And then you advance along the critical line looking for sign changes. You sample it here, you sample it there, you notice it's plus, it's minus, so intermediate value theorem, there must be a zero. Okay, so if you're just counting zeros, you don't have to zoom in. But if you want to do random matrix theory statistics, you actually want to evaluate that zero, and so you need more of a... more evaluations to zoom in. I mean, you could use linear interpolation, you could use quadratic interpolation, and that works very nicely, divide and conquer. So, I mean, you can quite quickly zoom in on your zero. Now, are there any missing zeros? So if you're just on the critical line, how do you know you haven't missed any? Okay, so supposedly the Riemann hypothesis is true, so we don't expect to miss any. You can use the argument principle to compute the number of zeros in a rectangle up to height t. Okay, but it's better to use Turing's test, and that's not the one for artificial intelligence. Okay, so he developed a test for verifying that you found all the zeros up to height t. Okay, so let n of t be the number of zeros in a rectangle up to height t. Okay, so this is from Heath Brown's talk. He obtained the following, that the number of zeros up to height t is main term plus a remainder. Okay, so that main term comes from the gamma function. And then the remainder is known to be of size O of log t. Okay. But more than that is known on average. Okay, so it's known on average. So Littlewood proved the first result, and then Turing made it explicit that on average, S of t is small. Okay, so if you divide by the length of the interval, you're getting something which tends to zero. Okay, so on average, S of t is zero. So if we miss a sign change, and when you miss a sign change, you miss at least two zeros. Okay, so you're going to quickly detect that. And the first time you do any of these experiments and you miss your first two zeros, you get excited and think that you've missed two zeros off the critical line. Okay? But sign changes misses two zeros. So let me actually... No, you don't want to, but when it happens, your heart stops beating. And it takes about a minute for you to realize that when you miss a sign change, there are two zeros you miss. For like 2 minutes, once in my life, I thought I had done it. But no. Okay, so here... Okay, so left column, zeros of zeta. The first one is 14 point whatever. Okay, this second column is S of t. Okay, so you just main term versus the number of zeros you found. As you say, you advance in step sizes of two. So just sample two apart. The zeros are coming closer together, so you will start to miss zeros. And the first time that happens is right here, when all of a sudden it jumps very quickly from being zero on average to two on average. Okay? Then over here, you miss another pair of zeros. And over here, you seem to miss another pair. Okay. I don't know. Divide and conquer. Well, that's pretty good. Is that? I mean, this column, the numbers aren't important. These are just zeros of zeta, but here, if you can just see that you go from being around zero to about two to about four to about six. Okay. So then you refine your step sizes, take step sizes of size one, and then you pick up that near that, in this region here, you missed the pair 49.7, which are closer than two apart. You missed this pair over here, and now this pair is still missing, so all of a sudden you get a jump of, you've missed two zeros, okay? So then you refine your step size further and take step size 1/2. Okay, and you find that missing pair over here, which are 0.8 apart, okay? And so you can automate this process and in this way very efficiently find zeros just by doing your computations on the half line. Okay, and this works not just for the Riemann zeta function. Take any L function, the same idea works. No one's really worked out explicit errors except, yeah.
How are you finding the argument?
What?
How are you computing the argument?
I'm not compute. How am I computing? S of t is just the number of zeros minus the main term. Right? Number of zeros, n of t, is main term plus s of t. I know how many zeros I found. Okay? I don't compute. I just compute that difference. And then sometimes I'm getting the wrong answer. I'm getting something which is like 2 or 4 instead of something which is smaller. That's how I know that I've missed zeros. Okay, so you can do this with any L function, at least experimentally. No one's really bothered to work out explicit errors for general L functions, so sort of like the Turing explicit form of Littlewood's theorem. Okay, but if you take the Ramanujan tau L function with coefficients tau of n, and these are the imaginary parts of the zeros, so the first zero is at 9.2, okay, you count the number of zeros, you subtract off how many you're expecting, all of a sudden over here you go up and you've missed a pair of zeros. Okay, so you refine your step size. That was step size 1, here's step size 0.5, and you find these zeros which were closer than 1 apart. Okay? Okay, so I'm going to completely skip over at Lipschitz's pictures, even though those are the most exciting in the subject. And let me just describe, there are other statistics that people have looked at for the zeros of this Riemann zeta function. And one experiment which needs to get more publicity, I think, is by Percy Diaconis and his student, who's now at Chicago, Mark Coram, who looked at correlations. Okay, so what they did... Okay, so the Keating-Snaith philosophy says that at high t, you should compare the statistics of the zeros of the zeta function to a matrix of dimension log t. So instead of looking at large n limits, you should really look at finite size matrices to get better comparisons, okay? So what they did is they took the zeros of the Riemann zeta function, they just broke them up, say, into blocks of length 20, consecutive zeros, and then wrap those around the unit circle, okay? And then you count how many zeros fall in this interval compared to how many zeros fall in that interval, so quarter arc length of the circle. And you see if there's any correlation between the number in this interval to the number in that interval. Okay, so when the intervals coincide, I mean, they are correlated and you get a 1. Okay, so it's statistical correlation. And so the theoretical prediction for size, whatever it is, 20 by 20 matrices or 40 by 40, okay, is that curve. And then what you get by doing this numerically with Lipschitz's data is this nice histogram that fits the theoretical prediction very nicely. Okay, and then you could do the same experiment with unequal intervals. And so for any experiment they did of this nature, they got a very nice fit between the theoretical prediction coming from unitary matrices and from Lipschitz's data. Oh, this is statistical correlation, so let me put up this line again. No, this is, I mean... Yeah, so... Yes, I... This can be expressed as a trigonometric as a sum of trigonometric functions. I can write this down in terms of the pair correlation or in terms of. Yeah, but the. Yeah, so. I mean, that's the definition. I mean, you. And so I don't know the answer off the top of my head to that. Okay, I mean, they published this in a Stanford sort of university inner document, so they just refer to it, and so I don't know how their derivation goes. Oh, it has appeared, but the paper I mentioned doesn't just quote the...
No, that's also okay. That's a very Keller dichotomy.
And Baum. Okay, so... Okay, so...
Just last year.
Okay.
But I was asking that because if you have a point correlation, it means that you are representing the two points
in a different way. That's true.
Looking to the same object.
Okay.
It is important to know if you are looking to new things or
I think this is a new thing because this is a longer range correlation. Yes. Okay, so I don't know the answer.
How is it related to the line and the circle?
The line is the theoretical prediction, the circle is zeta data.
The distributions on the line.
Oh, okay, so what you do is you have zeros on the line. That's a critical line. You take 20 consecutive zeros, and you just regard this as a unit. Okay, forget the circle. Just map this to the unit interval. Okay, and so then you're just counting how many zeros fall in one region, say of length one. Yeah. So map 20 consecutive zeros to a unit interval. Then you count how many zeros fall in an interval of length 1/4 compared to how many zeros fall in an interval of length 1/4. Okay. All right. Now, what about other L functions? So, for other L functions, a Riemann hypothesis, and a number of people have done Riemann hypothesis computations. I'll mention the ones that I've done recently. These involved looking at millions of zeros of Dirichlet L functions. So, where's that? Okay. So millions of zeros of various Dirichlet L functions, chi, Dirichlet character, mod q, so that these are the various q's and how many zeros I have for all Dirichlet characters to that conductor. For the Ramanujan-Tau function, 300,000 zeros for elliptic curve L functions, 100,000 zeros for various conductors, and thousands of zeros or 100 zeros for larger conductor. Okay, and in each case, RH seems to be true. It's not a rigorous computation in that I don't check that my floating point computations are correct to within. I don't do interval separation or anything like that. Okay, you can do paracorrelation comparison. So take the zeros of the Ramanujan-Tau function. This is from 1994, so an older computation with 100,000 zeros, and you have a nice fit. Okay, and these are for three other L functions, elliptic curve L functions, with about 1/10 the data, which I currently have. Okay, so you get the same phenomena occurring. You can look at the spacings distribution. Okay, compared to the spacings distribution for GUE, and again, you get a comparable fit that you get with the Riemann zeta function with the same number of zeros. Okay, so it's impossible for these L functions to compute zeros at height 10 to the 20 or even at height 10 to the 12. Okay, you can maybe go up to height 10 to the 6, 7, 8 if you're clever enough. One reason is the order of the complexity to compute these L functions. For the Riemann zeta function, it's root T at height T. For these L functions, it's T. Okay, the other thing is you have to compute the Dirichlet coefficients. In the case of the Riemann zeta function, all the Dirichlet coefficients are 1. Yeah, I mean, this very few zeros. I mean, this is the first 6,000 zeros, and things are behaving on a logarithmic scale. So by now, for this one, I could test it. I have 16 times more zeros, and I'll bet you that this disappears and looks more like this. Okay, let me just mention this sort of L functions that I'm going to be talking about. Okay, so Riemann zeta function, Dirichlet L functions with a quadratic character. So chi d of n is plus 1, minus 1, or 0. Okay, if d is prime, then chi d of n is 1 if n is a quadratic, if n is a square mod d, if n is not a square mod d, and then 0 if d and n share a common factor. Okay, then we have elliptic curve L functions. So, and then you might twist them. So you might take an elliptic curve L function, a n over n to the s, and then this 1 half is, I mean, some people, algebraists prefer not to have the normalization. Analysts prefer to have it just so that the functional equation, instead of being from s to 2 minus s, is from s to 1 minus s, okay? But that's not important. And then you can multiply all the coefficients by Dirichlet character. And all these functions have analytic continuation to C and functional equations relating the values at s to 1 minus s. Okay, in these three cases, it's due to Riemann, Hurwitz, and Wiles and his friends. Okay. Okay, so I want to talk about density of zeros. Okay, so that's a statistic that one might look at. So you look at the density of zeros near the critical point. So let me show you what the zeros look like for a family of L functions. Okay, so what's my family? I'm taking a character mod Q, a complex character mod Q, chosen randomly or generically. Okay? So for discrete set of Qs along this axis, I compute the imaginary parts of the zeros and then I plot them. So say Q is equal to 17. So that would be over here, and then I plot all the imaginary parts of all the zeros, you get a dot. Okay? So for each L function, I have a set of dots that lie on a line corresponding to the zeros, and you can see for a generic complex Dirichlet character, the zeros of Ls chi are uniformly dense. I mean, as you go out in this direction, you're actually getting, it gets a bit darker because there's some normalization you have to take into account. But there doesn't seem to be much preference for the zeros to lie in any specific part of the plane. Well, I know, yeah, this little thing here.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's, that's like, I don't know if that's dirt or some. Yeah, that's dirt. So. You start to go crazy when you stir these pictures because you start looking for subtle things. And you do notice them, actually. Okay? Now, if you contrast this picture with this picture, instead of looking at complex characters, I look at a real character, so Ls chi d. Okay? So I do the same thing now. Okay, so d is your discriminant, which is can be plus or minus, but it's essentially, it's the modulus of the character. So d in absolute value is your q. So here d is going from minus 10,000 to plus 10,000. You don't get a d at every integer. You get them at essentially the square-free odd integers, or 4 times those, or 8 times those. Okay, and you do the same thing, and you see that the zeros are not uniformly dense. Okay, they have a preference. First, they tend to lie in these bands, so there's some oscillation. You can also see that the zeros have a preference to avoid the critical point, to stay away from the point s equals 1 half. So you have this little gap here, this white space. And if you look closely, you'll see these bands running across. Over here is one. Or let me just put my next picture. Okay. Those bands come from secondary terms. Okay, so I'm going to talk about the density. You get a main contribution that corresponds to random matrix theory, but then you get these secondary terms, which involves zeta on the one line. Okay, and zeta on the one line Okay, this is a crummy plot. I'm showing two curves here. One is zeta on the half line, and that's the one that touches. So that's the first zero of the Riemann zeta function, second zero. And then there's a second curve here, which is the absolute value of zeta on the one line. Okay, and you can see that those two quantities kind of fluctuate in sync. This tends to break down as you go out further, but at low t, the minima of zeta on the one line are very close to the zeros of zeta. Okay, these bands you're seeing, it's actually not zeta on the one line, but zeta 1 plus 2 it. Okay, so the minima which occur at points which are very close to half the zeros of zeta. So the first band occurs roughly at 7. So you get this kind of what's been called resurgence of the Riemann zeros, but it's not really the zeros which are showing up, but the minima of zeta on the one line. This should break down. You can plot and you'll find regions where they just know. But they actually track each other amazingly well for quite a while. This is just empirically from these pictures, but it's something for somebody to study. So here's a problem. Okay, so let me talk about density. These bands here, the sand dunes, that's what I'm going to talk about now. Okay? So I'll just tell you ahead of time that I think the term n-level density is bad because you tend to think of that as n-level density, but it's n-level density. Right? So the one-level density, when you're just looking at how dense the zeros are, in this case, there's a fluctuating term. Okay, and I'll just tell you what it is. And so that's what gives rise to these kind of sand dune ripples. Okay, so n-level density is used to measure the density of low-lying zeros. Okay, so for one of the classical compact groups, okay, so take a matrix in one of the classical compact groups, right? Their eigenangles lying between 0 and 2 pi. Okay, so I'll just review stuff from what Brian's been talking about. Okay, so we're interested, you apply a test function, so think of this as a characteristic function if you want, okay? So you're just counting how many zeros lie within a certain region, okay? And you have to normalize by n over 2 pi. So there's always normalization that you do when you do any of these statistics. Okay, and because of that normalization, this thing is sensitive to the small theta j's. Okay, if your f has compact support, say, you're only going to pick up the first few zeros in this fashion. Okay, so Katz and Sarnak worked out, and that's in this book over here. So the prop is courtesy of Chris Hughes. And he, or they, worked out the following family-dependent results. So as you average over, so G is one of the classical compact groups, and you average this thing according to Haar measure, so you have a nice limit, so you written in terms of your test function and then some n by n determinant. Okay, and here's a table which tells you what the different answers are for the different classical compact groups. So you get distinct answers for unitary group, unitary symplectic, orthogonal even, orthogonal odd. The one level density in the unitary group is just the function 1. Okay, so you get this uniform density. So that's the first picture we saw. The one-level density for this family, which seems to be relevant for Dirichlet L functions with real character, is 1 minus sine 2 pi x over 2 pi x. So you get this fluctuating thing. Okay, so if you do the same statistic for the zero, say, of LS chi d, okay, so that's your L function, you label the zeros, so for each d you have a set of zeros. You look at fundamental discriminants up to x, so essentially these are square-free numbers. Okay, so then you do the same thing. You test how many of the zeros lie within some region, okay? You would like to take a characteristic function of a box, say, but if you want to prove anything, you have to assume things on F. So the main assumption is that its Fourier transform have compact support. Okay, so that's the same sort of assumption that Montgomery had to make to prove his paracorrelation result. And then you average over discriminants, okay? And the normalization here, instead of normalizing by n over 2 pi, you normalize by log d over 2 pi, or since you're taking d up to x, by log x over 2 pi. And it turns out that you can prove that this tends to the same thing that you get for unitary symplectic matrices. Okay, so this is a theorem, but it assumes that f hat, or that f is smooth and rapidly decreasing, and that the Fourier transform is compactly supported in some region. Okay, so this is the region where the diagonal contribution makes gives the main thing. Okay, so now you go and you want to test this without these sort of restrictions. So you want to test it numerically for your test function being the characteristic function. Okay. And so here is the theoretical one-level density. Okay, so the curve is 1 minus sine 2 pi x over 2 pi x, and we're checking how dense the normalized zeros, so you normalize by log d on 2 pi, how dense they are near the critical point s equals 1 half. And you notice that the zeros stay away from the critical point, so that was that white band we saw on the bottom of the picture. And this comparison is against this 1 minus sine 2 pi x, 2 pi x is the one-level density for unitary symplectic matrices. Okay. If you do the same experiment, okay, and let me say this is for d. So what I've done is looked at several thousand LS chi d's with d of size 10 to the 12 and computed the first few zeros. Okay?
So the sine function
is always plus 1. Okay, so the naive way to do it this is my emergency slide to go over the heuristic. Here's your group UN, US. Is some unitary symplectic, orthogonal. The eigenvalues fall on the unit circle. In these two cases, unitary and orthogonal, they come in conjugate pairs. The characteristic polynomial has a functional equation in each of the three cases. Okay, in the unitary case, you get a sine, which can be some arbitrary complex number. In the unitary case, you always have a plus sign in the functional equation. In the orthogonal case, you have a plus sign or a minus sign, depending on So if you look at SO2n, you always have a plus sign, and SO2n plus 1, you always have a minus sign. Okay? So if you're getting in your, if you look at your L function family, if you have a lot of just arbitrary complex numbers in the sign of your functional equation, it means you should look here. If you have minus signs, it means you should look at SO2n plus 1. If you have plus 1, then how can you tell? Often you say, well, if it's always plus 1, then it'll be here. And if it's always, or if it can be sometimes plus and sometimes minus, then you should be orthogonal. But Sarnak gave an example, and Brian also mentioned that he has an example where the sine, you make a family which always has sine plus 1, but actually has orthogonal statistics. I mean, we don't understand where the zeros are coming from, so we don't really know how to predict which of these you get. You have this heuristic, and then you do a few statistical tests, and you just see which one you do get. Okay, so this was for LS chi d. Now, if you twist, say, the Ramanujan-Tawal function, there the sign of the functional equation can be plus 1 or minus 1, depending on whether chi d is an even character or an odd character. If it's even, then the one-level density is 1 plus, you'd get a fluctuating term, but there's a plus sign. So that's the solid curve, and if you compute several thousand LS chi d's with d in the range of a few hundred thousand, you get a nice fit to the prediction. Okay, you can look at other statistics. You can look at the distribution of the lowest zero. Okay. So again, LS chi d, Dirichlet L functions with d of size 10 to the 12. You compute the first zero and then you normalize it by log d over 2 pi and see how it's distributed. That's the histogram, and the solid curve is what you get for large unitary symplectic matrices, and it's given by this formula, which is derived in Brian's lectures. That's the previous trend. Oh, the density? But for Dirichlet L function.
No, the one that moves over here.
This one plus?
Yeah. The statistics is very good.
What? Okay.
The statistics is very good for that.
It's not as good as for Dirichlet. I mean, I have more limited data. My D is smaller. Yeah, so...
Because, so that you don't attach any meaning to the D.
I mean, you can work out secondary terms. So, yeah, so you can work out secondary terms. And it's what I was saying, if you, in that picture where you had these faint lines running across, you get these secondary terms, which in the case of LS chi d, the secondary terms involves the Riemann zeta function on the one line. And you can also give some meaning to the secondary terms here. Okay. Okay, so that's the distribution of the lowest zero, okay, for LS chi d. You can look at the next zero compared to the unitary symplectic prediction. And you also have a very nice fit. Let me point out this curve is not the GUE curve. It's not this GUE spacings curve, even though it looks like it. You compute these eigenvalues using a program that Odlitsko borrowed from some physicists. Okay, you can also compute these statistics for finite n. There, it's just a discrete, you know, it's like an exact computation, and so you can also do it in that fashion. So I had one more slide here, which I wanted to show.
So you plotted the infinite distribution back.
Yeah, that's the large. So I haven't done it for these things. So that's what the Keating snake philosophy says, that you should get a better fit. There's also a bit of a cheat, because when you actually do the distribution, you're kind of off, and that's because there are these secondary terms which shift the mean by an amount which goes to zero, but logarithmically slow, like 1 over log d. So the mean you actually get is 1.84, but if you, so this picture is actually, the histogram should be shifted over, but if you renormalize to have the random matrix theory mean, you get a perfect fit. Okay, so that's the only cheat I've done in this picture. Now I had a picture which compares, okay, if I find it later on, I'll show it, which compares this thing to the GUE curve, and it's like with the Wigner surmise, they follow each other very closely, but they're actually distinct curves. Okay, you can do the same thing. Okay, the first zero of LS, or the Ramanujan-Tawal function, so you twist it and it's... So it's tau n over n to the s times chi d of n. There, if you want to normalize it, you could put in a plus 11 halves here, but that doesn't affect the zeros. Okay, so you look at the distribution of the lowest zero, and there you get an answer which follows very closely the distribution of the lowest zero of large orthogonal matrices. Okay, so you get a different answer. Okay, so now yesterday there was a question, what if you look at height 10 or something? So if you look at Ellis chi d and its zeros, okay, so I'm going to show you kind of a movie which shows a transition from unitary symplectic behavior to unitary behavior. That's the universal answer. So U makes sense also as a U for unitary, but U for universal. And as you move away from the critical point, if you look at the distribution of the lowest zero above not just a critical point, but say above height h. So critical point would be at height 0. And so you get this unitary symplectic answer. But then as you move away, so move away slowly, the transition you get is spontaneous. I mean, you get a universal answer away from the critical point, and at the critical point you get this answer. But with finite data, you're going to see it move continuously. Okay? So this is the first zero, the distribution of the first zero above height 0, or then above height 0.2. Okay, you keep going. The curve is the distribution of the lowest zero for unitary group, for large unitary matrices. So you look at... Okay, unit circle, and then you look at the... Okay, so the first zero for unitary matrices, and then you ask yourself, how is that angle distributed, or how is this arc length distributed? And so you normalize by n over 2 pi, theta 1, that's your first, and you ask, what's the distribution of the first zero in this family? Okay, so for unitary matrices, you get this smooth curve. They both are, but you get a universal answer. So unitary looks like this, and unitary symplectic, the distribution of the first zero is a different thing. Okay, so unitary matrices, you can have small first zeros. Okay, unitary symplectic, you don't. Okay, you tend to repel away from the critical point, even though there's no zero there. It's weird. Okay, so as you move away from the critical point, you quickly settle down on the universal answer. Okay, so this is the distribution of the first zero of Ellis chi d above the point a half plus I, or a half plus 2.5 I. Okay, so I'm now fixing, here's my experiment, critical line. I pick a height, 2.5, and I ask myself, what's the first zero above 2.5? And that looks like the unitary universal answer as opposed to the unitary symplectic answer you get at the critical point. So what this picture emphasizes is that you can only detect which family you're in near the critical point. Okay. So that's it for zeros. And now I want to talk about moments. Okay, it's kind of getting harder and harder to give a talk which gives an overview of all these results because we're having so many results. So that's a good thing, but it makes my job more difficult. Okay, so moment conjectures. One? Yeah, because I get blown away. Okay, so moments. Okay, so I'm just quickly review the moment conjectures, right? Because we've seen these a few times. Look at second, fourth, sixth, eighth moments. Those Riemann zeta function, theorem, conjecture of number theory, Conry-Grosch, Conry-Gonig. Okay, so the 2kth moment of zeta is asymptotically some power of log t, the power is k squared, times a rational number, which is predicted by random matrix theory, times some arithmetic constant that comes from number theory. Okay, Keating-Snaith conjecture, that's the form of that rational number. Hmm. Okay, so that's what been discussed in talks during this workshop. Okay, so I want to show you numerics which confirm this conjecture. Unfortunately, it's not enough to take just that leading term, okay, that ak log t to the k squared times this rational number will give you very bad numerics. And it's important to work out the lower terms in this conjecture. So not just log t to the k squared, but log t to the k squared minus 1, and so forth, all the way down to a constant term. Okay, so that's something which we now have. Okay, so this is work with Brian Connery, David Farmer, John Keating, me, and Nina Snaith. Okay, so the conjecture is that you can approximate the moments of Riemann zeta on the critical line using a polynomial of degree k squared and log t, whose leading term is a Keating-Snaith leading term. Okay, so that's not so useful because we already knew that. Okay. I mean, we're saying a lot more here. We're saying that there's a remainder of size. So we're integrating up to t, so we get square root cancellation is what we believe. I should say that Goldfeld and his camp have haven't told you what our approach is, but there are two camps working on this problem. There's ours and theirs, and we have sort of a different approach to the subject. They all give the same leading term, but we were able to identify very precisely all the terms. Okay, so what do the other terms look like? Well, here is your polynomial of degree k squared in x. And this is a 2k-fold residue taken about the origin. Okay, so that's your homework. This is school, so that's a homework problem. Show that's a polynomial of degree k squared in x. And then the integrand is something horrendous, and I'm not going to really discuss in minute detail what these things are, but this function that appears in the integrand involves the Riemann zeta function and then some messy Euler product. And there are many different ways you can write this. It's actually analytic at the origin, even though it doesn't look like it is from this expression. So that's the conjecture. So reasons that we believe this formula: first, it agrees with what's known for k equals 1 and 2, not just the leading term, okay, but the full polynomial of degree k squared. Leading term is the same as before. There are heuristics based on the approximate functional equation. That's the sort of thing that David's presenting. There is an analogous formula in random matrix theory. We have numerics for integer k up to 7. And in fact, you can interpolate the right-hand side to complex k and then verify this for complex values of k as well. Okay, so maybe at this point I need... Okay, so let me just show you some examples. Okay, so when k equals 1... this thing that appears in the integrand is actually very simple, and you can work out the residue as x plus 2 gamma, Euler's constant. And that gives you, for the second moment, not just the leading term, which was worked out by Hardy, but also the secondary term, which was worked out by Ingham. Okay, for the second moment, the fourth moment, so k equals 2, so we're looking at 2kth moment. Again, you can work out the polynomial explicitly in terms of known constants. Numerically, the polynomial looks like this. It's a degree 4 polynomial. Okay, notice the leading term is much smaller than these secondary terms. If you want to know what the polynomial is, that's what it is. Okay, x to the 4, x cubed, x squared, x, and constant term. And these things here involve Euler's constant and its generalization, so the things that appear in the Laurent expansion of zeta, and also derivatives of zeta at s equals 2. That comes from this thing here. And I should say that this agrees with a theorem of Heath-Brown as worked out by Brian. Okay, so I mean this polynomial is implied in a theorem of Heath-Brown. Okay, for k equals 3 or higher, let me put the conjecture up again. This thing that appears in the residue, okay, or in the integrand, okay, this Euler product over primes, the local factor is very complicated, and you don't have anything nice explicit in terms of known constants, okay, when you do your residue. But you can numerically evaluate the polynomial. Okay, so that's what it looks like, and we've computed this to dozens of digits using the basic techniques which I talked about on my first lecture. I mean, just as a little step. I mean, but this residue can be computed to high precision for integer k, but the complexity grows with k. All right, so it's a degree 9 polynomial, and notice the leading term is of size 10 to the minus 5. So if you want to check this conjecture, you do need these secondary terms, which are hundreds of thousands of times bigger. Remember, you're plugging in for y log t, okay, which grows slowly. So you do need these terms here. Okay, so let me just show you a comparison. Just for k equals 6, we've done this for k going for k equals 3. So the 2k equals 6. We have this for k going up to 7. So the 14th moment. Okay, so this column is okay. So what am I comparing? I'm comparing the 6th moment of zeta evaluated over intervals of length 50,000. So from 0 to 50,000, from 50,000 to 100,000, 100,000 to 150,000, and so forth. This is our conjecture. So you integrate over the same interval this degree 9 polynomial in log t. So this is what you get conjecturally, this column. This is what you get by numerically integrating zeta over those blocks of length 50,000. And that's the ratio. You can see them fluctuating between, above and below 1. Okay, so the conjecture and the actual numerics you get do seem to agree to within square root. So you take blocks of length 50,000, you should get about 2 or 3 decimal place comparison. Okay, if you take a block of length 2 million, you get an agreement to about 5 decimal places. Okay, so there are many different moment conjectures you can make for various families, for Dirichlet L functions, okay, for elliptic curve L functions. So let me just end. So you could see I had a lot of experiments here. Yeah, but I think it's better just to not overdo it and just... I mean, we can talk privately about these things if you want. I mean, anybody, not... but, I mean, Nina already knows this stuff because she's, you know, a colleague. Okay. So look at elliptic curve L functions. So, so these... are degree 2 L functions. They have Dirichlet series an n to the s. Okay, so the ans are related to the number of points on an elliptic curve So they're constructed for, so first you look at the APs, and those are given in terms of the number of points on an elliptic curve modulo P. Okay, so you have LE of S is equal to this thing. Okay, so then you can twist your elliptic curve. Okay, so this has a functional equation which can be either plus one or minus one. In the plus one case, we believe you get orthogonal plus statistics. Okay, now these L functions are different than Dirichlet L functions in that they can vanish at the origin. Okay, so no one's proven that Dirichlet L functions, at the critical point, I should say, so no one's shown that Dirichlet L functions don't vanish at S equals a half. Okay? But these L functions can vanish at the critical point S equals a half. And here you need to stick in that. Okay. Okay, so you might ask yourself, how often do you get vanishings? How often do these L functions vanish at the point S equals 1 half? And that's something which you can use random matrix theory to predict, but we haven't gotten fine control over this question. But we are able to make the following very precise prediction. Okay, so if you look at the number of... Okay, so now I'm using the algebraic notation. So you're looking at vanishings at the point S equals 1. Okay, so these L functions have a functional equation relating the values of S and 2 minus S, and the critical point is at the point S equals 1, at least the way I'm writing it over here. So count how often you get vanishings, but sort those... so sort your D's according to whether chi D of P is plus 1 or chi D of P is minus 1 for a fixed prime P. Okay, so here's your experiment. You fix a prime P. You compute which LE1 chi D's vanish, and then you sort them according to this criteria. Okay, so you have a ratio. Now, what's that ratio? Is that ratio 1 or something else? Okay, so this can be answered in terms of the moments. So how do you handle this problem? You compute moments in this family, moments in that family. And the answer involves the ratio of moments. Okay, and the ratio of the moments happens to have a very simple form that depends on the prime P that you're fixing. And AP is the AP that you get, is the Pth Dirichlet coefficient. Okay? And the way that this quantity depends on that quantity is you're supposed to plug in k equals minus a half. Okay, so I don't know if, John, are you going to... Okay, so you plug in k equals minus a half, and you look at this... Okay, so that comes from the moments which have their first pole at k equals minus a half. Okay, so there's a prediction which comes from random matrix theory that says that this ratio should look like this. So you take discriminants up to large T, you count vanishings in this family compared to that family, and you have a nice simple number to compare it against. Okay, and you can test this for many elliptic curves because these APs depend on your elliptic curve. Okay, so here's...
Say in the ratio there that maybe you already did, that you're just looking at plus functional equations, right?
So you restrict yourself. So I said it in words that these guys can have a plus sign or a minus sign in their functional equation, and we restrict ourselves to those that have a plus sign, because if it has a minus sign, then you always get vanishing at the critical point. Okay? So now when you twist, you have to restrict yourself further according to... So the sign of the functional equation when you twist is chi d of minus n. So, I mean, you're restricting yourself... Okay, the sign... that you get if omega is plus 1 or minus 1 for your underlying elliptic curve, then the sign of the functional equation for the twisted one is this. So we're restricting to d such that this thing equals plus 1. Okay, so it's after you twist that you want to have a plus 1. Okay, so here's the conjecture. So take the elliptic curve of conductor 11. That's one of the curves that Brian mentioned yesterday. And so then you twist it. You look at L S chi d, and you count vanishings according to these two criteria. You look at the ratio. Here's the conjecture. So the conjecture is this quantity, which depends on P and on AP. And here's the data. And if you compare these two numbers, you'll see they track each other quite nicely. Okay. You can do the same thing for various elliptic curves. So we looked at three elliptic curves. And in each case, okay, so the conjecture is this thing, but does depend on P and AP. So you get different numbers here than you did here. And then when you do the comparison, they do track each other very nicely. The difference, so here you get 0.90, here 0.89. The difference, we believe, will be of size O of 1 over log T. Okay? So if you're taking discriminants up to T, then we believe that you get a O of 1 over log T. Except in the case where AP is 0. In that case, our refined moment conjectures that give you the lower terms actually predicts that instead of being O of 1 over log T, you're going to get O of 1 over square root T. So whenever you have an AP, which is 0, so then you get square root P plus 1 over square root P plus 1, which is 1, so like over here, then you should get much better comparison. Okay, so you'll notice in the table that when you have 1s, the fit is much nicer. Okay, so you see it very well in this curve of conductor 32. So whenever there's a 1, you have much better agreement than just O of 1 over log T. Okay, so that's all I'll talk about for today.
Questions?
So, Mike, how do you compute the sixth level of the Zeta factor in the numerical?
For that, that's not a very extensive computation. I've asked Odlisko if he could maybe use his data to check this at large height, but this height was, you know, up to 10 to the 6. So for that, we use Mathematica because it has numerical integration routines built in. But you do have to be tricky because Zeta is fluctuating quickly, and so you do have to input a list of zeros, and then so you know you have these humps between the two zeros, and then you break it up like that. Otherwise, the fluctuation might make things difficult.
Any more questions?
Why is that first coefficient, which is the important one, so small compared to the rest?
That's a good answer. Do you know what it is? So, what are the asymptotics of those coefficients? So that's our next research problem, right?
I just wanted to know why the first one was so small.
You want to know why the Keating state is so small?
If you compare, okay, so let me just give you, without talking about the number theory, whatever it is, and then you have a product. So if you want to know what the the full moment polynomial is of degree k squared in random matrix theory. Okay, so it's let me go from 1 to k. I think that's how it goes. So it's roughly this. Okay, so this is a polynomial of degree k squared in x. So that's sort of, or if you want, x is your n. Okay. So it's a degree k squared polynomial in n. Okay, so you might study the asymptotics of these coefficients and see, that the leading coefficient here, forget about this thing, is 1, and then the coefficients kind of grow, and then at the very end they shrink. Okay, so, that doesn't answer the question about zeta. I mean, to do that, you have to know about the asymptotics of those coefficients. I mean, we've worked out the first, we have explicit expressions for those coefficients, so if you want to know the first 10 coefficients of the moment polynomial for zeta, we have those given in terms of sums over primes of hypergeometric, these complicated expressions, and you could, for any specific coefficient, work out the asymptotics, and you could talk about the ratio of the second to the first, or the third to the second. Okay, so you could answer that very specifically for any handful of first few coefficients. But it really seems that the coefficients that matter, it's a degree k squared polynomial. Okay, and if you look at the coefficients, they start off really small, then they grow, and at the very end, they seem to kind of come down, and that very end seems to be something like k squared minus k or something like that, some constant times k. So the coefficients that matter are the ones which are really way out there, not the leading coefficients. So you have to do some sort of uniform asymptotics on those coefficients. And that's a hard problem, okay? Because we have an implicit form for this polynomial as a residue. Okay, and to answer questions about the far out coefficients, we want something which is much more amenable to analysis. So, that's a big problem. Okay, so if for the problem session, that's I guess another problem.
Any questions? Thank you.